Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, lovely listeners. This is your host, Mel Barrett. I wanted to give you a heads up before we dive into this live recording with Pamela Smart. The audio isn't great, from about 2 minutes and 40-ish seconds to 3 minutes and 30 seconds or so. But once you get through that minute, it's pretty good. Pam called us from a prison phone, so we all did the best we could to get her words to you live. But please be advised, the audio isn't pristine. Not like when I record myself in my closet. I hope you'll stick around and share this story and podcast. This is a really important conversation. Thanks so much for listening.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30. Why?
Wanted to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
Date is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a .38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, I need a policeman. 4D, Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help outside.
Welcome to the In Between Podcast Live. I am your host, Mel Barrett. I am here with my co-host, Ellen Marie Marsh of I Think Not and Robbie and Ellen Solve the Case. We are here tonight live with a very special guest to talk about the Pamela Smart case and her new appeal that she has going on. And that very special guest is Pamela Smart herself. She's calling us from prison.
Well, I am very happy to be here as a co-host of one of my newest favorite podcasts. Thank you all for joining us. And this is truly remarkable. Any minute now, we're going to be getting a call from Pam in prison. Of course, we have prepped our live audience that anything can happen because, you know, it is prison.
Prison.
We're hoping that she'll be able to answer our questions and talk to us. And we don't know what to expect. Mel knows Pam very well. They've been in communication on and off over the past 10 years. And I think we are all, because of just the way the world is and, of course, the In Between podcast, we are beginning to look at this case a little bit differently. So I am so honored to be here. And I am really excited for you all to hear from Pam directly. And our live audience will be able to ask her questions. And we're just all really excited.
Oh, I'm getting a phone call.
Call from an incarcerated individual at New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hey, Pam.
Hi, Mel.
How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. First of all,
okay.
I appreciate you. I know this is not easy. I know it's not easy to get on the phone and, you know, at a certain time of day and all that stuff. And I just want to say this is sort of a first, you being able to speak directly to an audience of people who have questions for you and who want to talk about your case and spread the word. So without further ado, everybody, welcome Pam Smart. Everyone is going to remain really respectful in this chat. You're going to be talking with me the whole time, but there are going to be questions coming in. So I'm going to ask you the question. And you can answer them however you see fit. But first of all, can you tell us a little bit? It's so ridiculous to say, can you tell us a little bit about your life? But give us a little bit of an idea of who you are and how you're feeling about everything.
Well, I'm a person that stays really busy. So I do a lot here. And my days are filled with a lot of work and responsibilities and different organizations that I work in, helping other people that are incarcerated here. I think I stay busy because I don't want to dwell on all of the negative things about my life and my circumstances. But I have found that in the last few years, especially, it's just getting harder and harder to deal with the reality that I'm facing now. So I find myself feeling a lot sadder than usual and kind of, you know, lifting myself up out of spaces that I'm trying so hard not to get stuck in.
It's one of the things that I notice, and it sort of breaks my heart whenever I hear in your voice how down you are, because one of the things that I've always been worried about in making this podcast and trying to tell the story is giving you any kind of false hope. And I remember we had this conversation one time where I said, you know, I always feel bad sort of giving you good news because I don't want to create false hope. And you said to me, no, please give me the good news because I can't create the hope on my own anymore. And that sort of just kind of crushed me in the moment. I just want to introduce you, Pam, also to my co-host, Ellen Marsh, who's also a podcaster. She's here with our audience and she's going to be sort of moderating everything. And there are a bunch of questions that are going to be coming in through the chat. There are a couple of people here who wanted me to tell you that they're here. One of them is Jules. And let's see, Jules, who was in Bedford with you, and Sammy.
Yes. Okay, great. Oh, I love them. Okay, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah,
they totally lifted my spirit.
So, Pam, tell me a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing with the other prisoners. And, you know, I think I mentioned in the series that you have a ton of degrees. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've studied over the years and, you know, what you'd actually like to do outside of prison?
I got my first master's degree in the law, actually, and criminal justice. So I got that, you know, towards the end of trying to understand a lot more about the justice system myself, but also educating myself enough that I can help my peers in the advocacy roles that I take on inside here, which are every single day. So my second was in English literature, and I pursued that really because they were offering it here, and I just have a really curious mind, and I love to learn. I love to be in school, so I did that, and then my third master's was in professional studies through a seminary, and that was through New York Theological Seminary, and that was a lot about leadership and working in spaces for advocacy. So that was like right up my alley. Then I got a PhD in biblical studies. I'm a very spiritual person, so I wanted to understand more, not just about the religion that I believe in, but other world religions. Obviously, as a facilitator for our community here, our Protestant community here, I give a lot of sermons and a lot of words of encouragement to the other incarcerated individuals. So I'm always needing to be up on biblical studies and, you know, learning as much as I can. So I did that also, you know, to be able to help other people. And, you know, just to keep myself, my mind strong and focused, and not to allow myself to just waste away inside here. Because I feel like if my mind is not active and my body is not active, then my soul will be crushed.
Right before you got on the phone, we were actually talking about the documentary. We're going to get into the appeal in just a second. But one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, because I know this is difficult. You've done a lot of media. The general public has always sort of gotten on your ass about doing so much media. And now here's another documentary. I know it's frustrating to you sometimes to have to continue to tell this story. Can you give us a little bit of an idea about how you're feeling about telling this story again? And maybe what are the most important things to you to make sure that the general audience knows is fact, truth, and who you are?
Well, I first want to say that I don't want to do this. I hate doing interviews. I hate having to go through this all over again. It's emotionally exhausting. It weighs my spirit down. It's very hard, and I don't like it. There's nothing, you know, it doesn't feel good. There's nothing that is good about it when I'm doing it. But I feel like I'm boxed in with a choice that I can either just stay in here and die, or I can try to tell my story and hope that people out there will see that I'm a person that needs justice and mercy and compassion.
You know, we talked about this a lot in the podcast, and I hate to think that the state of New Hampshire is sort of out to get you, but it does feel sometimes like
it's just out to get women.
Yeah, it's just out to get women. But it does feel like if you were in any other state in the country, including New York, where you actually have lived for the past 34 years, that they wouldn't be so harsh. I can't quite figure out why they can't let you go. They've let everybody else go. All the murderers are out walking the streets, still living in the neighborhoods they used to live in when they were kids, when this happened. And for some reason, the state of New Hampshire cannot let you go. I know you're angry, and it's okay to be angry. If you can give us your thoughts about why you think the state of New Hampshire is so against you, that would be, I think, really interesting for the audience to hear.
I think when I look at it, it's that because my trial was televised live, and it was before made for TV movies and before reality TV, my trial preempted all of the soap operas on ABC. And so it became a soap opera for people. And it became...
That's a great point.
You know, I became a person, a villain, that people could hate and throw all of these feelings they had onto and create this caricature of a person that they hated and could be angry at. And I think it's hard for people to let go of their solidified opinions about me. And so now when I ask a governor to be merciful or compassionate and release me, they look at me as, you know, generating for me as political suicide because they feel that the people there are against me. And sometimes I do get letters from people in New Hampshire that say, you know, hey, you know, everybody here doesn't hate you. Everybody here doesn't think you should stay in prison forever. But because those people are not vocal about it, then I think that politicians and other people that do have the power feel like they can't make this decision, or they don't have the courage to make the decision to let me out because they feel like they're going to be known as the person who let Pam Smart out of prison, or
ego based.
And I also feel like the fact that I was that I am a woman was really harmful to me in the media, because people judge women differently, and women are not supposed to do bad things. Women are not supposed to, you know, go outside of the norm. Men have affairs every day, and people just look the other way, and it's not a big deal. But when a woman does it, all of a sudden she becomes a slut and a whore and all of these other things. And I believe that those, you know, most of the people that hate me, they hate a person that I'm not even that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the things they hate about me, they feel that I'm selfish, that I'm mean, that I'm evil, that I'm all of these things. And people that know me know that I'm none of those things. So it's like they just hate a person that they never met. And now, you know, when you hate somebody and that just gels inside you, and you hold that year after year after year, it's hard to say, hey, I was wrong about judging someone, or just let go of those negative opinions.
It's the juxtaposition between her and the Menendez brothers, because our image of the Menendez brothers 30 years ago were these spoiled brats.
Yeah.
And now time has changed. We've learned more, but it doesn't seem like Pam has received that same compassion. Well, a little bit within our niche, group,
yeah.
But like to the world, she's still the slut who, had her lover kill her husband, but we've given that grace to the Menendez brothers,
Why do you think that there's a disconnect between people like the Menendez brothers or Scott Peterson compared to your case?
I think, again, it has to do with the fact that I'm a female and people just don't like women to have erred on the wrong way. I mean, it goes all the way back to the Scarlet Letter and, wearing this badge of shame. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and it was, Eve's fault that Adam ate the apple. It wasn't Adam's fault. And, we have this concept of a fallen woman in society, and it just sticks. I think a lot about Joey Buttafuoco and Amy Fisher. When that situation happened, Amy Fisher was 17 years old and Joey Buttafuoco was like 35 years old, married with kids and whatever. And he was literally accused of the same thing I'm accused of, having a sex with a younger person and having them kill your spouse. And the only difference is that Mary Jo Buttafuoco didn't die in this situation. And Joey never spent a day in prison.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what is that about? So when I look at the Menendez brothers, I'm going to be completely clear that I really don't judge people's cases, especially after what I've been through, because we never know, even with all the media coverage, what pieces we're missing of who people are. I do not think that given the fact that they were horribly abused, that they should be in prison for the rest of their lives. But I just look at the situation and I say, wow, this is insane that because they got celebrity and help or what have you, or maybe because their families have money, that all of a sudden they're getting this second look, and I'm just sitting here.
Yeah.
So it's like people have equated freeing me with somehow not valuing Greg's wife, like denying one of my petitions for commutation. One of the executive counselors in the New Hampshire governor's office actually said to free me would be somehow diminish the value of Greg's wife.
The murderers are free.
And when I heard that, I was like screaming at the air, why was no one concerned about diminishing the value of Greg's life when they released the people who killed him?
Exactly, exactly.
These people come out and they feel like they have to speak on behalf of Greg. Where were they when Greg's killers were being released? No one was speaking on behalf of Greg then. No one cared about diminishing the value of Greg's life then. They just let them go, and that was it. And these are people that, from their own admission, from the stand, laughed on the way home after they murdered Greg, talked about the thrill of killing. And what happened to Greg, the value of Greg's life in that space?
Right.
It didn't exist. But when it comes to me, everyone's worried about that. And seriously, Greg was the most compassionate and caring human being I ever knew. He would never want someone to be, hanging on to vengeance and all this hate and everything. He would never want me to be in prison forever.
Yeah.
He wouldn't.
Yeah.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0 depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, to follow up with something, I want to put this on the record because I feel like everybody sort of goes back and forth and they try to parse words. You know, your previous lawyer, Mark Sisti, who was your lawyer for 34 years, you know, he actually went on NBC News and said something that was totally false, but said that it was coming from you. So I want you to be able to put the record straight. This is part of your appeal. So we'll get into that in a minute. But I would like for you to tell the audience about what responsibility you held in this murder.
Well, I know, you know, when I first came to prison, when I was first arrested, I had the belief that, you know, none of this was my fault because I knew that I didn't ask Bill to kill Greg. I didn't want him to kill Greg, and I didn't know he was going to kill Greg. None of this was my fault. And I think part of that was a defense mechanism because I did not want to be responsible for this horrible thing. I mean, who wants to be responsible for the death of someone you love? No one. So I think in my mind, I just faced myself so far away from this that I thought that there was no responsibility on my behalf at all. And after so many years of working on myself, of going through programs, of digging into learning, you know, learning about responsibility, about moving forward in my faith and all of that, I came to see just how responsible I really was. And in that, I mean by having the relationship with Bill. And I know that absent my four horrible choices, Greg would be alive today. So I am responsible for that, for his death in those ways. But does that make me criminally responsible? It does not. However, I know, and I have to carry that the person that I loved and wanted to spend the rest of my life with is no longer here, that all this harm was caused because of my choices. Families were hurt. My own family, it was broken and hurt. I ended up losing my life inside prison for all of these years. All of those things are my fault. That happened because of my terrible choices. So carrying that burden is heavy. And because I have that every day, it's like, what can I do to rectify that? What can I possibly do, you know, to somehow ease or repair the harm that I caused? And the only conclusion I can come to is that I can do as much good as I possibly can with the life that I still have. And I've tried to do that. And for me, that's honoring Greg the best way that I can.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, it is very powerful. And I just want to put it on the record. Did you have any responsibility in the planning of the murder?
Not.
It's interesting. What always strikes me is that when she has come forward with this realization, the haters were saying, oh, she's just saying that to get out. So it's like, okay, so we call for accountability. We scream for people to be accountable, remorseful. And then when they are, she's faking. But same thing when we, again, Menendez brothers, I mean, I'm just using it just because it's, you know, on the tip of my tongue. We give them the opportunity to atone, but she's still a bitch that needs to rot in jail, even though she did exactly what everyone has been saying. Be accountable for your part. And now she is, and she's still a bitch.
This happened when you were 21, 22 years old. If I got into trouble for some of the things I did when I was 21, 22, and I was in jail for the rest of my life, I mean, it's a mess to me. But you've had 34 years to make amends, figure out what's important to you in life, how you can honor Greg. And one of the things that I said to Paul Maggiato, the prosecutor, when I talked to him was, Paul, for 34 years, she has been adamant. And this was before, just so the audience knows, Pam would not accept a plea agreement from the state of New Hampshire.
Why would she agree to something she didn't do? I totally get it.
When she was 21, 22 years old. And so, for 34 years, you have remained firm in that you were not involved in the planning of this murder. And to me, I have to give that some credit. I have to believe that anybody that would say for 34 years, life without parole, I did not have anything to do with the planning of this murder. But everyone's telling me, if you just say you're guilty, if you just take accountability, which is what Ellen was talking about, they want you to literally say the words, I was responsible for planning my husband's death. If you did not do that and you are unable to say that, then you are in that catch-22 between a rock and a hard place. And for some reason, it's good enough for the Menendez brothers, but it's not good enough for you to sit down and think about your life and think about all the things that you've done and say, I take responsibility. I made bad choices. My bad choices led me here, but they shouldn't, you know, punish me for the rest of my life because I had an inappropriate relationship with a 16-year-old that turned around and killed my husband. So I don't know if there's a question in here for you.
It's just frustrating that she is finally accountable and there are people out there that are still not satisfied.
Yeah, it's frustrating that you talked about your accountability and there are people out there that are still not satisfied with that. So can you comment a little bit on that?
I mean, yes, I can. Because there are people that would not be satisfied with anything. If tomorrow I woke up and said it was all my fault and I did it and I planned it and everything, there would be people that would say she's just saying that so she can get out of prison. So there would be no way I could say anything that would satisfy everybody. But I do know this. Like, I have long contemplated these things and I have so, like, I cannot make myself become free to live in a complete lie. Obviously, if I say that I wanted Greg killed, right, the next logical question would be why. I can't even think of a reason that I could make up that would make any sense right now, because there is no reason why Greg had to be killed. There was no, you know, big insurance money. There was no house and car and the kids and all of this to lose. In fact, the prosecutor never put forth any motive because no one can even come up with one that makes any sense. So it's like, I don't know how I cannot be any more accountable than I am right now in saying that I'm responsible for the fact that he's not here anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to call back. Okay, because the calls only go for a half hour.
Right. Will you be able to call back, or is that going to be a problem?
No, I'll call right back.
Okay. Before you call back, I want to start talking about the appeal, some of the points that are in the appeal, and how you feel about what's happening. I guess the last part of that would be, what can people do, you know, to get involved? We'll talk about that a little bit more when you come back. So why don't you, if you want to hang up and call back, we can do that right now, and then we can start putting some questions together for you. Would that be okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Thanks, ma'am.
All right. I'll talk to you in a minute.
Yep. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It's so fucking preposterous. Like, and that's the thing, you know, when if everyone saw, she made, I don't remember what the video was for. I mean, I saw it on YouTube and she basically said what she said. She's like, you know, all of this time I didn't realize. And people are like, well, she's just saying that. We just sat, everyone was screaming for accountability, and then she came around to it in her own time, and we're still saying it's not good enough.
Yeah.
And she's absolutely right. It's all of these fucking big guys that are not going to go back on their word, not going to admit they were wrong. It's totally ego-based.
Yeah.
It is the most blatant form of sexism.
Yeah.
I think we all need to change our vernacular.
I hear you.
Collect call from
Pamela Smart. Hey, Pam.
Okay.
Okay. So I want to start talking a little bit about the appeal. I know that it hasn't been filed yet. You know, Matt and I have become very close, good friends. And, you know, we have a tendency to get on the phone and talk for hours at a time trying to figure out how to prove all these points of the appeal. You know, we've sort of gone through everything. A couple of things came up when I was researching for the podcast that I think are going to be helpful. One of those things we can't really talk too much about because we're not allowed to use this person's name yet. But, you know, one of the things that happened in my research was finding that interview with Charlotte Jeffs that a reporter did with her and then gave the transcript to your mom. And in that interview, Charlotte Jeffs says the reason she convicted you was because Bill Flynn cried on the stand and because you had put out a hit on Cecilia Pierce. Now, for those of you who haven't gotten to that point in the podcast, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but there was nothing brought up in trial about Pam taking out a hit on Cecilia Pierce, which means that this one juror who had already been brought up for juror misconduct actually was reading media and using that media to help her make a decision about conviction. So that's, I know, one of the points they're going to be hitting on in the appeal. Is there anything else that you can tell us about, well, how you're feeling about it? This is the first appeal in, I think, over two decades, right?
Yeah. Well, I haven't actually seen the draft yet, so I can't comment too much on it because I'm literally waiting for it to get here any day now. I have such a hopeful heart. I'm just generally a positive person, and I'm someone who looks at the good in things, not the bad. So although we did have our conversation that you brought up earlier about hope and it being fleeting for me and coming and going, I feel like for so many years I've had what I like to call a defiant hope because it's just a hope carved out of hopeless circumstances. And it's for me like a protest against the hopelessness of, you know, that others have declared upon my life. And so I am hopeful about the new appeal. I'm very hopeful about my new lawyer because he's really excited. He has very passionate about it. And he brings energy that I have, the same kind of energy. Mm-hmm. And so I really can flow with him on that level. Mm-hmm. And he's excited about it. So his excitement is contagious, and I feel excited about it. It's like, but I always have this cautious hope because I have just been so crushed, you know, many, many times throughout the years and hoping for things and then them just getting my hopes dashed all over again. So I feel like I have to protect myself, my own mind and spirit in some ways by not, you know, putting all of my hope in places. But it's like I can't help it either at the same time. So, you know, I feel like my hope is spiritual too. I know that God has a plan for my life and I don't think this is it. So I know he puts people in places in my life to work towards a better end. And I feel like Matthew and his team came in out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they're, you know, divinely appointed and this is the team I need to make this happen. So I do feel excited about it.
Yeah. You and I have talked about this before. I've been around off and on for about 10 years. We started talking about 10 years ago and we had a lot of really, you know, I think we used to talk all the time on the phone back in the day. And I did feel like I became your friend. And so, you know, when I start thinking about this and I think about, you know, your hope and the hope being dashed, I think about the criminal justice system, you know, is full of people who have lost hope because the system repeatedly tramples over them. In this situation, I can say personally, for the first time in 10 years, I actually have some hope, which I didn't before. That's the hope that I was like worried about sharing with you because this does feel different to me. Can you maybe just pick a couple of points from the appeal that you feel strongly about and maybe we can talk them out here?
There's a lot going on about instructions that the judge gave the jury. Mm-hmm. and that were not correct. And a lot of things about choices that my lawyers made at the time that were very poor and actually boxed me in to places where I didn't fit. And so being that I was so young back then, I didn't understand the law. I didn't understand the whole system. And I was in shock half the time about what was even happening to me and all the media coverage. And it was just so surreal that I didn't even understand what was going on around me. And to object to some of the things that were happening. thing, but, you know, there's a lot of strong points concerning my lawyer basically is saying that I was guilty of witness tampering, telling the jury that when I wasn't, and I had testified for days about that, and so it was just like going against what I had just testified about, and apparently, according to the law, that's not allowed to happen, and, you know, other things about the judge and the jury and what he withheld in certain circumstances concerning Bill and his friends and letters we received and him not letting them back into trial again for us to cross-examine them about them.
So less of it is about the context of what happened and most of it is about courtroom misconduct, jury misconduct. Is that, like, is that a safe assumption to make about this appeal?
Jury misconduct, the judge's instructions, a lot of it has to do with the way the trial happened, not necessarily
the legalities of the case, not necessarily
the legalities of the case, not necessarily what actually happened in the case. I would actually say, knowing what I know about the appeal and what we discovered, some of that is true. There's also the wiretaps. Now, the wiretaps were the only evidence used against Pam. And in my research, I finally, after 10 years, got a hold of the actual wiretaps and the transcripts. And I was, so the transcripts for the audience, if you don't know, the transcripts were created by a nameless person in the DA's office. Nobody to this day can tell us who created those transcripts. They were not a certified transcript. We've only been told, and I'm using this word in quotes, that a secretary created these transcripts based on wiretaps that you could, they were almost completely inaudible. And that's me saying that as somebody who listens and edits audio all the time and was able to actually enhance them a little bit myself. I went through one of the tapes so far. And in going through those tapes, I discovered many, many, many inconsistencies between what was actually being said on the tapes and what was actually in the transcripts. The transcripts were never used as evidence in this trial, but they were given to the jury as a guide to the wiretaps. Now, if you're looking at something on paper and you're hearing that that piece of paper is going to push your confirmation bias into, well, this is obviously what it says because somebody made a transcript about it. So
it's literally propaganda. Yeah. You see it, it goes into your brain. That's it.
Exactly. So, Pam, my question for you is, I would love for you to talk a little bit about the wiretaps. You don't get an opportunity to do that very often, but I know that some of the stuff that was on the wiretaps, you know, some of the words were misattributed. So it was actually Cecilia saying it when they said it was you saying it. If you listen to the podcast, there's a part in the podcast where I pick out one in particular that Maggiato, the prosecutor, used right in front of the jury on a whiteboard during closing, which is actually incorrect. The transcripts are incorrect as to what was on the tape. And he used that moment to turn around and point at you and say you were guilty. Can you talk a little bit about the wiretaps for a minute? I'd love to know anything that you want to tell us about them, including what made you want to talk to Celia Pierce in the first place.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
My lawyers had told me beforehand, do not talk to Cecilia Pires. She's probably coming in and she's going to be wired. So whatever you do, don't talk to her. And I hung up the phone with them and I called her because I wasn't worried about talking to her. I wasn't worried about anything because I wasn't guilty. So my mindset when I was moving through that time period was that I know I'm not guilty of this crime, so it doesn't matter what I do or what I say. I was very naive, very young, had no experience with the criminal justice system, and, you know, didn't know anything. I was very confused. I was stressed. My husband was murdered. Now a person that I had a relationship with was arrested. I wasn't sure why he was arrested. Did he really do this? And what happened? You know, it was just a lot going on in my mind then. And so when I first heard the wiretaps in, I think it was at trial. No, it was before trial. I kept telling my lawyers like, that the transcript wasn't going with what was said, or the way it appeared on the paper made it look like when someone's speaking and then the other person is, the first person speaking, the other person saying, yes, yeah, okay, just in furtherance of the conversation, mm-hmm. and not necessarily in agreeance with whatever statement was just said before that. And on paper, it looks flat. I wanted Craig dead, and then the person says, yeah, you mm-hmm. know, and it looks like, they're not saying it, you know, in front of a conversation, but as an affirmation of whatever the previous statement was. So there was a lot of that happening. Then there was a lot of stuff that it would say, it said PS or CP for whoever was supposedly speaking. And half our voices were very similar, and half the stuff they were saying I said or didn't, it wasn't even me. And then there were parts of the conversation that I know I had with Cecilia Pierce that were not in the tapes. So I was saying stuff was cut out of these tapes. You know, I had a whole conversation about certain things that, and it was never in any of the tapes. So I was trying to say things to my lawyers, and at trial, they just kept saying, don't worry, the jury's going to see through this. The jury's going to see through that. The jury, they're not stupid. They know better. They know they can differentiate. They can do this. And, you know, at my age, I trusted the lawyers.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, everybody was telling me, just listen, do what they say, whatever. And they kept making me feel like they were going to challenge these things, and then they just never did. And I know that when I listen to them, you can't even hear them. They're completely inaudible. In fact, Greg's father took his headphones off in the middle of the court proceeding and said, I can't hear anything. Yeah. And Diane Nicolosi, the prosecutor, did the same thing. Said she couldn't hear it either. So it's common sense that if you're a person and you cannot hear something, and then somebody gives you a written transcript of what's being said, you fill those things in your head. Mm-hmm. And then a judge comes and says, hey, don't rely on the transcript. If you can't hear it, you have to just rely on the tape. But you already read this. It's like putting toothpaste back in a tube, unringing a bell. It can't happen.
Right.
You know, the thing already happened, and you're trying to go backwards to say that it didn't. And it just reminded me so much of the HBO documentary about my case, Captivated, where they went back and they were questioning, I think it was Raymond Fowler, mm-hmm. and he was saying that certain things happened that were in the movie about right. the case and weren't things that happened in real life or at the trial. But even him, a person that was a key player in this whole thing, couldn't remember what he saw on TV and what really happened.
He even, in that interview with, you know, for Captivated, he said that. He said, I can no longer tell the difference between what actually happened in real life to me in this case and what happened in the movie. And we can go into a long conversation about memory and confirmation bias and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, all of that's going to be in the appeal, which I'm pretty happy about because the wiretaps have always stuck with me as something that was just completely ridiculous. And yet it's the only thing that they had as evidence, in quotes, to use against you. Now that we're moving into the appeal, what are some things that people who support you or people who want to take a look at this case and figure out ways to help, what can the audience do to promote the story and get behind the appeal, be on the ground in New Hampshire? Do you have any ideas? And what would you like to see from the audience?
Well, I would love to see some momentum as far as support goes. You know, a lot of times people watch something or hear something on a podcast or watch something on TV and they go, oh, that's really crazy. I can't believe that happened. And then they turn around and say, honey, what do you want for dinner? And it's like over, you know, it doesn't really matter enough to actually do something about it. And I just feel like when there's injustice, like anywhere, I feel like it takes away a piece of all of our humanity if we don't do something about it, if we don't speak about it. Mm-hmm. Even inside this prison, you know, all these injustices happen every single day here. Well, on a larger scale, just, you know, being in prison, period. And I'm constantly advocating for other people. I'm speaking up when something is not right, or I'm writing letters, or I'm reaching out to other organizations that might be able to help people, because our humanity is like inextricably tied together, and I think we need to start caring about people. And people in prison are often forgotten, and in this case, I know that there's people that write me even, and they say, I don't know if I think that you're guilty or not guilty, or I don't know what exactly I think about this case, but your sentence is insane and you shouldn't be in there. And then there's people that write me and say, I think you're guilty, but yeah, I think you should be out of there.
Right.
And so I feel like if we just step back and look at this and we say, okay, this person, like, I don't want anybody to think I haven't been punished for my part and my responsibility in this. I have lost my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, half of my 50s to imprisonment.
Yep.
Sometimes I feel like I can't even remember life outside of here, mm-hmm, because this has been my life for so long. I am literally, I have guards here protecting me that were not even born when this happened to me. Mm.
Yeah. That's wild.
And to me, when I look at that, it's like, wait a minute. Millions of taxpayer dollars are being spent to keep me in prison for what? Yeah. I could just do so much more if I were out of here.
Right.
So I feel like people, I would hope that people would mobilize and just say, this is wrong, and be vocal about it.
Yeah.
They could write letters. They could write an op-ed for the newspaper.
Yeah.
They could write letters of support for the governor or the court when the petition is actually filed.
Yeah.
If I do have a hearing, which is what we were asking for, people could show up and they could protest. They could lend their support to my appeal and start saying that this is wrong. They could make politicians in New Hampshire and judges more comfortable with doing the right thing. You know, if it's not so scary, if the public is saying, hey, let's take a second look at this, then judges are more inclined, which is sad because they should do the right thing anyway, but to, you know, it would make the climate a little bit safer to make the right decision.
It's so obtuse, right? Like, whose decision will it be to give her another hearing? We can't say judges, senators, Congress. Like,
yeah,
we need to mobilize, but we need to do it strategically. Who's the guy?
Well, when we file the habeas petition, it will be assigned to a judge.
Right.
Supposedly, that's random. I have no idea if that's how it really goes or not. But when we get a judge, that will be the person.
Right.
But we won't know until we actually file the paperwork. You might know better than I do. Now, they're talking about at the end of this month or the beginning of next month, correct?
Yeah, I think Matt is finalizing right now, and I think he's planning to have it filed within the next 3 weeks or so. And you know how long things take, you know, from there.
Once it's filed, yeah, then the state will have to respond to it.
Yeah.
File a response.
Yeah.
And clearly they'll probably ask for an extension.
And I'm assuming that, so what Jules is saying in the chat is that, but before it can get to a judge, it has to go through the district attorney. So the district attorney is who we should actually be putting pressure on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when it's literally filed, the actual petition gets assigned to judge whoever, mm-hmm. you know, and then the AG's office has to respond to my habeas, and we're asking for an evidentiary hearing. Mm-hmm. If I do get an evidentiary hearing, then that will be in front of whoever that judge is that it's assigned to. So I probably have to go back to New Hampshire for the evidentiary hearing.
And we will all be there to support you when that happens.
Believe me, I don't want to go back there. I'm afraid to go there. Sorry, I don't like to go back.
I just want to understand for our brains, because she's been in there for so long, does she understand the power of social media? She doesn't, I don't think, right?
The problem, Ellen, this is what I will say, is social media only works when you've got a person who kicks it off, who has a base of people. I've spent 10 years trying to get people involved. Sue Corcoran and Amy, who run the Facebook page, have spent 10 years, 15, 20 years trying to get people involved in this. And the only...
Someone's got to tag Rosie O'Donnell, because Rosie O'Donnell's the one...
I tagged Rosie O'Donnell. Yeah. I wrote her an email, actually, Rosie O'Donnell. Yeah. But, you know, that's how, like, Kim Kardashian got involved with the Menendez brothers and Santoya Brown and yada yada. So for all of us, we need to be able to find somebody that we can sort of inundate and be like, please look at this case and tell all of your followers, because social media is really important right now. And Ellen, you have a lot of followers and you have a big voice, but I look.
Now, it needs somebody, you know, like Donish, or, you know, someone who's got a million followers. But yeah.
I mean, I'm looking at like the Karen Reed trial right now. They are standing out in the cold in New Hampshire or in New England right now. And there's nothing really going on in her case, but they are standing on corners with signs.
Yeah.
You know, that is sort of what we need, and I want that to happen in New Hampshire.
We need to have some kind of a meeting.
What's extremely difficult in my particular case is this. I have such a groundswell of support in New York.
Yeah.
Okay? I have a support from senators. I have support from assemblymen. I have support from organizations, advocacy groups, people that were formerly, you know, incarcerated were here with me. I have all types of advocacy groups that I work with day in and day out from inside here to help their people, and connections that I've established with professors from programs and just all kinds of great connections. And they're all here, because this is where New Hampshire threw me to. So I have to try to get support and momentum in a state that where no one really knows me.
Yeah.
And that's the crazy part for me. I'm being judged by New Hampshire, okay? And not one single official from New Hampshire, from the DA's office, from the government, anywhere, has ever come here in 34 years to see what I'm doing here.
Right.
And the people who work here every day, civilians, officers, the superintendent, the commissioner of corrections for New York State, all of them are really supportive of me. See what I do every day here. They know me. And these are seasoned correctional personnel. And they're saying, why am I still here?
Yeah.
And, you know, if I had a hearing tomorrow in New York, I could probably assemble a ginormous squad of people. But it's like, when they say, gee, Pam, I wish we could help you, but all of our connections are in New York, and nobody knows anybody up there. So they threw me over here on purpose.
Yeah.
So that I couldn't have any support.
We've only got a few more minutes with you, and I do have a few questions from the audience that I want to get in. And guys, whatever Pam isn't able to answer, I will send her those questions and she can answer them in email, or maybe we'll do it on the phone again the next time that we talk. Pam, Ashlyn is asking what they can do to lift your spirits, and anything that they can send you, even just a letter.
Just the fact that you're tuning into this podcast is lifting my spirits right now. And I think you could share the podcast. You could just pray for me. I believe in the power of prayer. And, you know, you could write a letter of support for me, just saying that you feel like I should be given a second chance, or I should be released. And you can send a letter to me, and we can include that in any commutation or clemency efforts we have, or in support of the petition that's being filed right now, asking the judge to do, you know, be fair and do the right thing.
Yeah.
So yes, there are ways you can be helpful. But thank you for your support, everyone. I'm so grateful.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Yeah, well, you deserve it. I mean, I'm just glad that we're able to gather some people here to really hear your voice and to understand that you're a human being and you're not this, you know, thing that they've made you up to be in the news media. So do you want to call back, or are you getting pushed?
No, I can call back.
Okay, call right back, Pam.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, she's so well spoken.
Yeah.
She's so, like, you know, she just sounds like you and me, like just an ordinary lady, only she's fucking behind bars. I mean, I get it. While we're waiting for Pam to call back, just so you guys know, when we were offline, Mel and I were talking. Pam's real sassy.
Yeah.
And I was saying, you know, she is. She's sassy, but yeah. I would be too. And I'm sassy, and you're sassy. But when you're a woman, sassy doesn't serve you.
Right.
And you've got to placate, which is something that Rabia gets shit for all the time. And people call her aggressive and rude and all these things when she's actually. Actually, Robbie is much stronger than I am, but Pam's sassy, and my sass would be at a 10 if I was in jail for that long too, but it's not gonna serve her with those fucking old ass white men sitting there judging her. It's just not. Like, you have to play the game. Oh, officer, was I speeding?
Hey. So thanks for calling back, Pam. I've got a couple more questions coming in from the chat. One from Lacey. She says, I choose to be an optimist, so I'm gonna say when Pam is free. Would she ever go back to New Hampshire, or does she imagine starting somewhere completely new?
No, I would never want to go back to New Hampshire again.
Yeah.
I would love to go back to where I'm from, which is Florida, and I was born and raised in Florida, and I lived there the majority of my life. I went to New Hampshire for a few years, and then I went to college back in Florida, so Florida's really home for me. I lived 18 of my 22 free years in Florida. So I really especially want to go there because my mother and father are there. And right now they're, you know, getting very old. And my dad just turned 85 and my mom just turned 83 in November. And my mom has some health problems. And I really want to go home and take care of my mother and father, who are like the most fabulous parents in the world and have spent their lives caring for me. Mm-hmm. And I would like to be there for them. I actually asked the governor in my last commutation petition if I could go home under house arrest, and, you know, I don't care if I ever leave the house as long as I can take care of my mother and father. Mm. My mom, especially, she's been locked up in this cell with me for 34 years. She cries every day about this, and her heart is so broken. And I so want to be free just for my mother to have at least one night where she can sleep in peace knowing that I'm free. That would be just be the best thing. So I would go to Florida if I had a choice.
Yeah, I do have to say, your mom, Linda, and I have talked many times over the years, and that woman is tireless in her advocacy and work and devotion. And honestly, Linda is the reason why I was able to discover some of the things I discovered in the podcast, because she has saved every single piece of paper that has anything to do with you, your trial, anything. And she boxed it up and she kept it. And that's the reason I was able to actually find some of this new evidence and do something with it and track these people down, because your mom has been so diligent in fighting for your, you know, for your behalf. And all she wants is for you to come home. And I feel for both of you. And I'm annoyed because I know that, you know, and I don't know if the audience knows this, but Bill Flynn actually got work release before he was paroled. So he was on work release for, I think, 5 to 10 years, which is when he met his new wife. So he was actually leaving the prison every single day and having a normal life before he was paroled. And so the idea that you couldn't be on house arrest, it's insane to me.
So because my brother lives all across the country in San Diego, and my parents are you know, they're that stubborn generation where they don't want anybody to come in and help them, and, you know, they can take care of themselves. So really, they only want me there. And it's hard because, you know, they're getting, my mother fell last year. She broke her hip, and I thought I was going to die then, because it's just like I felt so helpless not being able to do anything, you know, from here. And that breaks my heart. It's like the biggest fear I have, that something's going to happen to my mother and father, and someone is going to come in this cold visiting room and just tell me that horrible news, and I'm going to be left with that and supposed to be able to deal with that from inside here. And I can't even wrap my head around that possibility.
It's hard not to think about it, but yeah. I don't want to put those thoughts into your head right now. I think that we need to stay positive and we need to push to get you out of there. And let's see, I have another one. Catherine wants to know, do you have any visitors? Can they bring you anything when they do come to visit? And how long can they stay? And are you permitted to actually sit next to them, give and receive hugs, take photos together, share a meal, etc.?
Yes, I do get visitors. I have a lot of visitors. I'm grateful for that. I have a lot of friends who come. I actually have a lot of formerly incarcerated friends that stayed friends with me and have created a good bond with me and left prison but didn't leave me alone and still come back and visit me too. We are allowed to hug in the, when the visit starts and when the visit ends. I am allowed to sit with them. We are allowed to share a meal, but they are not allowed to bring me anything. So yes, I can take photographs with, what do you call that thing, a Polaroid camera.
Yep.
Most people don't even know what that is anymore. It's funny because kids come in and they're like, what's that? Is that a camera? And it's like, yeah. I have my beautiful goddaughter, Pamela, comes to see me. She's actually coming Saturday with my friend, Dea, and I'm going to see them. So that's gonna really lift my spirits a lot. And yeah, I do get visits, so they can stay for a while.
That's awesome. And Bea is one of your best friends who you met in prison, and she named her daughter Pam after you. Is that right?
Yes, she was my best friend in here for over 20 years. And, you know, we went through so much together inside here, all of our struggles together. And she was really sad that she didn't have any children. And we used to talk about that a lot. And I was sad that I never had a child either. And she used to always say, when I go home, I'm going to have a baby. And if it's a girl, I'm going to name her after you. Because I helped her with school and so much. And she went home and she actually had a baby and she named her Pamela. So we have little Pammy, and she's just the light of my life right now.
Oh, I love that story.
Well, she came in and told me that I'm named after her.
She came in and said that you were named after her. Yeah.
Yes. She said that, you know, when Bea was like, this is Big Pammy, you know, she said, oh, my God, you were named after me. We'll just leave it like that. That's amazing. That's awesome.
I'm glad Bea's in your life still, and that we have people like Jules and Sammy checking in right now. And
I have my friends from home still that have been my friends forever. Sonia was my best friend since I was 15 years old, and she's still here. And Amy was my college roommate. I have another college roommate, Anne, and they're still in my life. So I have a lot of really, really good friends, both people that were incarcerated with me and people that knew me before this. They were Greg's friends also, my friends that I had before this. So they had to struggle with all of that. You know, they loved Greg and they loved me too. So, and they remained, they know me and they remained my friends.
I got that one of the things that really bothered me from the trial was how the prosecutors handled Sonia on the stand. I mean, just reducing her to tears. She wasn't ever able to fully tell her story. And so I was really happy to have an opportunity to get her on the phone and just have a conversation with her, you know, human to human, where I just said, tell me what you wanted to say when you were on the stand. And she was able to finally talk about who you are and what you were going through at that time and everything. So I was really excited to have that opportunity to talk to her. And I hope that it was good for her to be able to finally tell that story, you know?
I think it was, because Sonia is so sensitive and she cries all the time. I know she's probably laughing right now listening to me saying this, but it takes 2 seconds for her to cry.
Yeah.
So it was so hard for me to see her on the stand. It was so, oh my God, I was so sad and broken for her. But I know that it's hard for her to get through anything because she's just so emotional and she just gets so sad quickly. Sonia and my mother make a good pair. They just cry over everything.
I have to say, I didn't experience... Well, no, Sonia, she choked up a little bit. I've definitely... Your mom's pretty emotional. She's definitely cried on the phone with me, and I feel horrendous when your mom cries. I can't deal with it.
No. We all do.
Yeah.
My mom is like the most sweet, beautiful person in the whole world. And it's like when she's sad, it's just crazy because she just uplifts everybody around her. She's like this big light.
Yeah.
And so for her to have this horrible sadness inside her heart, I hate it. And I carry that burden too, you know?
Yeah.
I know that my mom is sad because of me, and there's like nothing I can do to get that away. She just wants me out of here. I'm her baby no matter how old I am.
Yeah, I would. The only thing I would say about what you just said is I don't think your mom is sad because of you. I think your mom is sad because the system has really failed your family.
Yeah, she is. But it just, you know, it just makes me sad when she's sad. So I try to be as upbeat as I can when I talk to her. And just try not to, if I'm sad or I have problems, I try not to burden her with them. But she's just... She just carries that sadness just all the time, and it's just hurtful.
I know. On another note, Jules says, love you, Pammy Cakes.
I loved my Jules, too. She's the best, her and Sammy. And they know this struggle. You know, it's hard because I have friends that are outside, and they can only do so much for me. And then the friends I have inside prison, they're there. You know, they're there in those moments when I say I can't do this anymore, when I feel like I'm going to explode, or when I just feel like I can't make it through another day. My friends outside, as much as they love me, or my own mother, they're not here in those moments. So being inside this struggle, you have an understanding that people outside just can never have.
Yeah.
I don't want them to have it. You know, I don't want them to ever be in here and experience this. But people who have gone through this, you know, there's this old saying in prison, like, oh, you can't find friends in prison.
Yeah.
And I always say, I hate it when people say that, because I found friends in prison. And I feel like when you're a good friend to people, you attract good friends. And so I think that I so value all my friends. I do.
I know you do.
You said something earlier.
You can say whatever you want
to say.
Yep.
Okay, you said something about I deserve to go home or whatever. And for me, I want to just make it clear that I really don't feel like I deserve anything in this experience. I'm not saying to the court, I deserve to go home, although some people might feel like I do. I'm not saying I deserve anything. I'm asking. asking, can we, is there anywhere in, that we can just put mercy and compassion inside this justice system? You know, we send people to prison to be corrected, to be rehabilitated or whatever. And then when they are, they take out.
Yeah.
And to me, that's just wrong. I don't think that maybe everybody should just never come to prison or what have you, but there comes a time when in people's lives where, you know, I'm not asking you to trust what I have to say about myself. I'm saying, listen, read these letters that people wrote in support. You know, listen to them. Mm-hmm. They're the professionals. Yeah. They're the experts. They're the ones saying these things.
Yeah. Well, and I would say it's my opinion that you deserve it because you have been punished in prison.
Let's be clear about that, too, because prison itself is punishment, but in addition to that, I've really suffered a lot of very horrible things while I have been here, too.
You have.
And so it's just it's an extremely oppressive environment, and the things that I've accomplished were struggled to even accomplish anything in here. Yep. And this is an environment that actually has gotten worse and is getting worse every day. But to constantly be oppressed and told what to do and pushed around and like physically beaten and abused in so many ways, and to try to accomplish anything against that backdrop is a struggle in itself.
Well, and that's why it's, I mean, I know that the prison is under new management, so that makes things really difficult for you. But past prison management, Elaine Lord, the superintendent of Bedford Hills, is one of your biggest proponents. I mean, she's written letters to the governor. She has talked openly about your rehabilitation. And she spent, I think, 20 years or so in there with you?
Yeah, superintendent for over 30 years here.
Yeah.
So obviously she has experience with these things. And yeah, she was great. I mean, she supported programs. She supported our changing and transformation and rehabilitation. She did.
Yeah.
She supported those things. And then she's saying, like, listen, I'm an expert in these things.
Yeah.
This is what I've done. And she's saying this lady should get out.
Yeah. I know you and I have talked about this, but can you share with the audience, what would you, if tomorrow you were able to walk out of there, what would you want to do for the rest of your life, either as a career or how do you want to live?
Well, I know that even when I leave prison will never leave me. The people here, the struggle of incarceration would never leave me. My dream job would be to work for the United Nations in prison reform and to speak and go out and talk and advocate, you know, for changes within the system that could help people that do get incarcerated to have their time spent, you know, learning and doing things that will help them change and protect people so that they won't come back and it won't be a system where it's a revolving door of people just coming and coming. Our nation has over 2 million people incarcerated and the system is bursting at the seams because of policies in the 80s and 90s where there were truth and sentencing laws passed that gave people so much time in prison. And now those same people have aged in prison and can't get out.
Right.
And the system is overburdened. And all of the reforms that come in always do carve out and don't include people convicted of quote-unquote violent crimes. So the system never releases people because, you know, at the top end, they have a lot of time because they have a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they can never get out. They're forever judged by whatever that one thing is they did. And I feel like if you commit a crime or if you do something, you owe it to society to help repair and mend harm that you caused. And there's so many ways you can do that outside of prison.
Yeah.
And people can't, you know, after a certain number of years inside prison or whatever, people, you know, people that work in places like this, they know who's real and who's not, who's changed and who hasn't.
Yep.
And when they speak about it, people should listen to them.
Right. Agreed. We have one other question. This one's from Lacey. This one's a heavy question, so I just want to prepare you. Does Pam feel like she's even got to fully grieve Greg's loss? We all grieve differently, but I can't imagine she has been able to fully process his loss from the start.
Absolutely not. And that is also a great question. I literally just got asked that same question 2 days ago. No, I don't, because it's like I was trying to grieve Greg's death, and then I got arrested, and then I was in prison, and then it was the trial, and then it was appeals, and then I got moved to New York and ripped away from my family, and then I got here and I got beat up when I first got here by other people, and I had that plastic surgery on my face, and that was, you know, the next thing, and it was the next thing, and the next thing, and I wonder all the time, like, where did all of that go? You know, where is it inside me, and what, how does it manifest itself, not having been able to properly grieve? And I don't know, but I do know that I have never properly grieved.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that Greg is not here sometimes just bubbles right to the surface in so many different ways for me. And then I realized that I did not ever have a chance to properly grieve.
Mm. I didn't really cover this much in the podcast, but I think about it often. You were 21, 22 years old when your husband was murdered, and you had to I just want the whole audience to imagine being 21, 22 years old and having to figure out how to bury your spouse and how to come up with the money to do that. And all the whole process, everything that has to happen in the death of a spouse. And on top of that, you've got a murder investigation. You've got the press following you around everywhere. You've already got the press saying that you're too cold. It's just insane to think about a 22-year-old person going through that.
Right. And it's like, I didn't know anything about buying a casket and preparing a funeral and all of these things. And then it was just so overwhelming because I didn't want to go back and live in the condo that this happened in, and having to have somebody move all my stuff and find somewhere to live. And I don't even remember half of it. It was like all this big whirlwind. And then the press started calling me saying that they were going to publish stories that Greg was a drug dealer and he owed money in Atlantic City and he was a gambler because he used to go there on junkets with his mother and father all the time. All this crazy stuff. And if I don't go on TV, I don't say, you know, who Greg was, then they're going to print this and they're going to say this. And it was, I didn't know how to deal with all of that. I didn't even know what that was about.
Yeah, you were 22 years old.
Yeah, people feel like, well, I was this adult, but I feel like I wasn't. I was maybe an adult in age, but obviously immature in so many ways, socially inadequate that I would even be having a relationship with someone who's 16 years old, inexperienced in relationship, and just overwhelmed by all of it. You know, I may have been academically inclined and going to school or whatever, but socially, it's way too immature.
Mm. I've got one more question. Ellen just came back, and I've got one more question from Ashlyn. Does the prison offer any mental health support?
The prison does offer mental health support. You have mental health counselors, and you can open a caseload. And I have done that at different periods in the past. I'm not seeing someone right now. But I have found for me that just talking about all of these things doesn't really help me. You know, the bottom line is I just need somebody to get me out of here. You know, that's like the answer for me. Like, I just feel like, what can anyone really do? They can just talk to me. They can listen to me talk about my problems. But I find that it's not really helpful for me.
Yeah.
What's most helpful for me is just staying busy.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm going to put you on speaker for a second so you can hear Ellen.
Hi, Pam. First of all, thank you so much for doing this. I covered your case on a different podcast with my other podcast partner, and that's when I became emotionally invested in your case. And I want you to know how much support you have in this chat and everywhere where people really understand the legal system, understand true crime, and understand your case. I'm sure it's hard for you to feel that kind of support where you are, but it is here, and I want you to know that. The question I've always wanted to know, because I do understand the ins and outs of your case, probably not as, you know, the minutia to the level that Mel does, but I would love to know, what is the one thing that if you, you know, had the eyes of everyone who thinks a certain way about you, that you could tell everyone something deeply personal to humanize yourself to the naysayers that don't really understand how wronged you have been?
I would say that I am not my worst mistake.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I am so much more. I'm a sister. I'm a daughter. I'm a godmother. I'm a person that has compassion and mercy for people. I'm someone who cares more about other people than myself, but I'm a flawed person. I'm a person that made mistakes, made poor choices. I look back at my younger self, and I can cry from my younger self because I was so, my self-esteem was so low, and I was so broken when Greg cheated on me that I look back at myself, and I can see where, to me, it's so, like, it's embarrassing, and I feel so ashamed and sad that I was so broken that I needed someone 16 years old to validate me, to feel good about myself. And, you know, it's shameful to say that, to look at that. You know, I'm not proud of that. I'm embarrassed by that. But I feel like I'm able to look at myself and to see the flaws, but I also know that I'm a good person with a kind heart, and I'm someone that I feel like could be and give and do so much more outside of these walls, that if given a second chance, I would be so humble and so filled with gratitude that I know I would make my life count for something important. So I would want people to just not judge me and box me in to my worst mistake and feel like that just defines who I am, because it doesn't.
Yeah. That's a great answer. Yeah.
Do you have anything else, Ellen?
I am very activated. I think that we have a very loyal and supportive community within the podcasting world. There was a comment in the chat where, you know, I'm going to say when you get out, the world is so much different than it was 35 years ago. And I do think you're right. I think that the conversation needs to happen in bigger ways. And I just want to make this promise to you that we will do it. We will write the letters. We will make the calls. We will make the social media posts, because our lens of the way we look and understand people is different. And I keep going back to the Menendez trial just because it's on the front of my brain. But it's true. Back then, we looked at these spoiled little boys and no one wanted to hear that they were being abused. And I think it's the same thing, you know, making people say, what were you doing when you were 20? 21. And I think that your humility and your accountability, and you are so passionate the way you speak. I hope public speaking is in your future if you do get out, because you are so inspiring. And I think you are the absolute epitome of how the legal system treats women differently than they treat men. The actual men who committed this heinous crime are walking free, and we are talking to you on a collect call from prison is just, it's the perfect example of that. And I know we're all going to scream it from the rooftops, and I hope I get to hug you one day. And I just want you to know that Mel has...
Thank you.
Been championing you before this podcast. We talked about you, and she believes in you, and she's been working tirelessly.
You've got 1 minute left.
And I love your relationship that you two have.
I'm going to leave it open to you, Pam, because you only have a minute left, but thank you from the bottom of my heart. We'll catch up.
I want to say thank you to you, thank you to Ellen, thank you to everyone who's listening, and I am so grateful and I appreciate you, and may your kindness that you've extended towards me be returned to you tenfold in whatever you do, and be blessed, and I'm just so happy that I have your support, everyone, and I truly appreciate it. I'm really literally humbled by it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pam. I'll talk to you soon, okay? Please have a good night. Stay strong.
Okay. All right, take care.
All right.
Say bye to all my friends, Jules and Sammy, Sonia, everybody.
Yeah.
Amy, okay?
Okay.
All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye. Thanks, Pam.
Wow. I am very emotional. I am, you know, I have seen her sassy side in interviews and everything. We were talking about her sassy side, but she's absolutely right. And just when she said that, you know, she was embarrassed and that her self-esteem was so low, you've said it in your podcast. We talked about it on me and Rabia's podcast. Like, yes, it is wrong to have sex with a minor. And you put it there and you hear her shame, her regret, her embarrassment. And then you think like, yeah, she was just a hurt, insecure 21-year-old girl, and there's this boy. We've all, not with a minor specifically, but we've all taken the affections mm-hmm. of the opposite sex or the same sex or an intimate partner, and that has validated us. There's nobody listening who can't say that they haven't had the validation that maybe casual sex or, you know, sex you're not supposed to have, or if you've cheated or any of those things. We've all made those mistakes, not on the same scale. But like when she said that, I got really choked up.
I've said this, I'll say this every single time that we talk about this. I am not in the habit of defending people who have inappropriate sexual relationships
yeah.
with people who don't want it or who are underage. That being said, I was 15 in 1990 and these things happened. And we, as kids, sought them out. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying that there were so many people involved in this case. There was this core group of kids who were age 15 to 18. And then there was a core group of adults who were hanging out with these kids. And unfortunately, that's the way it was back then. I hung out with, at 15, 16, I hung out with 20-somethings all the time.
Who let me date a 33-year-old when I was 19?
Yeah.
I mean, technically I was an adult, but I wasn't mentally an adult. I was legally an adult. And this 33-year-old, remember when we were in high school and kids would come back for college? There'd be like 22-year-olds at our high school parties.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, who did that? And I'm not defending her either, but she's not asking for our forgiveness for that. But
well, she's not defending herself either. She's saying it was wrong.
And did she serve her time for that? You know, I mean,
yeah.
I'll say it. The time that some disgusting sexual offenders, we just covered an NYPD who molested his 5-year-old neighbor, and he got, what did he get? 18 months for ruining a little girl's life?
Right.
It just, it again, the disparagement between men and women. And I don't know. I'm so grateful to her. Truly, I think she should be a public speaker talking about her case. She's so passionate. She's so well-spoken. She's filled with humility. you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just...
She wants to... Her ideal dream job is for the UN, honestly, talking about prison reform. But you know what really pisses me off about that is everything that you're saying is true. And on the other side of it, they will dwindle... And by they, I mean Paul Maggiato and many other people in New Hampshire will dwindle her down to, oh, she's just a manipulative bitch. That's just her manipulating you, Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't with it anymore. I'm so sick of that. One of the things that I did want to tell the audience before, I know everyone's been on for like an hour and a half, and I appreciate you guys being here. I think that that was really good for Pam. She's never had that before, and it was really, really important. One of the things you can do right away to help if you want to get involved is, so her legal team is working pro bono. Matt Zernheld has become a very good friend of mine. He is an amazing human being, not just an attorney, but he spends his day in and day out trying to help people who have either been wrongfully convicted or who've had their constitutional rights violated. And he is getting people out of prison after 30, 40 years. My point is, the man is a saint, but he is doing this for free. He has a family. He has a wife, a small child, and one baby on the way that's coming February, hopefully February 7th, because that's my birthday. So if you can find it in your heart or you have the extra resources to do so, go to payit2.com. It's P-A-Y-I-T, the number 2.com, and search Pamela Smart. There is a legal fund. They're raising money. They've raised about $5,000. They need about $75,000 just to pay Matt's paralegals and to get these experts in. I know that Matt will go forward with this case, whether he has that $75,000 or not, but I also know that that's going to put him in a very tight position financially. So please go to payit2.com and search Pam Smart, even if it's $5. It all adds up. If 100 people gave $5, you know what I'm saying?
And beyond that, I mean, you know, we can also brainstorm. I mean, maybe we can get some grab bag people in to brainstorm. I know Ashley works in fundraising. Maybe we can do a fundraiser. Maybe we can do an auction. Let's think outside the box, because that is the one thing I have learned about the podcasting community, about our grab bag, our ITN, our Rabia community, is that we are all so diverse in our gifts. Mm. You know, I was telling this woman, you know, that I'm helping out with this case. I was like, we have law enforcement, we have military, we have lawyers, we have doctors, we have moms, we have researchers. There are so many people at our fingertips, and we need to use all those resources. So I think, Mel, we need to sit down and maybe have some kind of a town hall meeting, you know, on Zoom. This is an injustice. And it doesn't matter, even if you think that Pam said, you know, go kill my husband. The fact mm-hmm. that the murderers are out and she is not, that should make you angry. That mm-hmm. should activate your insides. That should raise your cortisol levels, because that means it could happen to any of us.
That was my point. Yep.
And we have seen wrongful conviction after wrongful conviction. And this is a woman who, you listen to her talk, she can do something.
She can do something for the world.
And she's just sitting there. So I think we need to use this time to think as a community, to think collectively, and to make action. Why else do we sit behind these microphones other than to make a difference, you know?
That's the whole reason. I mean, this is not something that I ever really thought about doing or wanted to do.
I mean, I'm still getting paid by the Petersons. You know, the Scott Peterson's family still funds my life. Mm-hmm, so poor you. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. But yeah, it's not like any of, you know, it's not like any of us are rolling in the dough. But let's get those ideas going. So donate to the fund if you can, and then I think we need to hone in on the best people to contact. I think maybe, Mel, if you talk to Matt and say, I've got some people ready to make calls, ready to send emails, ready to write letters.
Yeah.
Give me a list, because I think we can get some movement. And I think I'm going to do something on social media. Whenever you see something about it, you know, like, share, comment, even if you put an emoji.
Yep.
You know, those are things that boost algorithms and getting the word out there.
And I would also say, this audience that is listening right now, most of you have been on Patreon and you subscribe to listen to my work, to Ellen's work. But Grab Bag, because they have been in such big support of this series, have given me a general feed on Apple and Spotify. And I can think of no better way than to get this story out there by hitting like the rate button, the subscribe button, reviewing the podcast, because for a blip of a moment over Christmas and New Year's, the podcast shot up to 51, number 51. Like, it got into the top 100 true crime podcasts on Apple. And the more people hear this story, the more outrage there will be. The problem is that not enough people have heard this story. So
heard this version of the story.
This version of the story. That's the problem. They all think they've heard it before, but they actually haven't. If you guys can make a push on Apple and Spotify and get this podcast going, tell people about it, share it. That changes the algorithm and it gets the story out there. And believe me, it would make me so happy to have, you know, a top podcast. But my goal with this has always been to get as many ears on this story as possible. Because just like the 25 of you and me and Ellen are outraged, I feel like if everybody heard this story, they would be the Karen Reed level of outrage, which is exactly what this woman needs right now. So,
yeah. Well, Mel, thank you for allowing me to help you. Thank you for the audience that is live in the chat.
Thank you to the audience.
Thank you all for listening. And I say this all the time, you don't have to have money to help. It's not about money. It's about getting ears on it, people on it, tagging people that you think will help. The power of social media is immense. Mel, I want to congratulate you again on this tremendous work you have done with your debut podcast. It is insightful. It's so well done. Thank you for taking out all the breaths and
I'm gonna be cutting a lot of them out of this, I can tell you that much.
And your work is great and I can't wait to see what else you do. I'm so proud to have been a teeny tiny part of the growth of this podcast and I'm proud to call you friend. You are a wonderful human, you are a wonderful friend, you are a wonderful podcaster, stepmom, all of those things, and I love you dearly.
Wait, I get to say thank you as well. And so for the audience that doesn't know, the reason this podcast exists is because of Ellen. I think I've been talking Ellen's ear off about this story for probably 4 or 5 years now. And then Ellen did the Pam Smart story with Rebecca and Kevin from Crime Writers on Robbie and Ellen Solve the Case. And I heard it and I was like, are you guys friggin' kidding me? No one called me. No one wanted to talk to me about this. But as soon as they did that, I started talking to Ellen and I was like, Ellen, I think I should be making this into a podcast. And she was like, abso-friggin-lutely. So I got a little bee in my bonnet and I put together an episode and she told me that I was breathing too hard. And then and then I re-edited that. And then I got Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On involved. And they both encouraged me. They gave me notes and they encouraged me to pitch it. So this story wouldn't be out there if not for Ellen's encouragement. Also, your connections to Grab Bag. You introduced me to Grab Bag. And I love you. And you're an amazing human being. You have the biggest heart. And I appreciate you. And I think that we can make this happen by getting everybody out there. So
let's do it, y'all. Come on, let's get angry. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, audience. I appreciate you guys so much. It means a lot to Pam. So thank you for being here and thank you for giving her a little bit of hope that she says she doesn't know how to make on her own anymore. So anybody who wants to get in touch with Pam can email her at jpay.com. You'll search up Pamela Smart. Her inmate number is 93G as in good 0356 and she is at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. Purchase stamps, send her emails, she'll get right back to you. She's really good at writing back. So again, jpay.com, Pamela Smart, inmate number 93G 0356 Bedford Hills Correctional Facility.
I'm sure those emails really brighten her day. I'm sure any kind of correspondence brightens her day. So if you have a couple minutes and you want to send her something to lift her spirits, I think that would be a beautiful thing to do. Y'all, chat, you're amazing. Go on Grab Bag on the Facebook and, you know, just make a little post or comment and just say how awesome it was. I want to get people talking. You know what I mean?
If you guys wouldn't mind, I would super, super appreciate it if you could just go quickly rate the podcast on Apple and Spotify just so I can bump up in that algorithm and get this story out there. I really appreciate you. Pam really appreciates you. We're going to organize and get something going here. Okay, I'm going to take off because I really have to pee. Okay, bye guys. Thanks so much. The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umble. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grab Bag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do.
And I want to send another shout out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay, your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grab Bag Collab main Patreon feed. Until the next time, be good people and don't do murder.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.